Six Music.
Discover more mixes from Six, from some of our favourite and most exciting artists on the BBC Sounds app.
BBC Radio.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with John Grant.
You are at the height of your game, aren't you? Would you not say that you agree, baby? You got your grift all fine-tuned and sparkling. Yeah, you got your board look all worked out, out. You are all enlightened, nothing makes you frightened. You ain't got no time to waste on entry-level middle class. You are super silly, yes, pretty and ridiculous. You got really good taste, you know how to cut and paste. What you got is a black belt in BS, but you can't hawk your pretty wares up in here anymore. Hit your head on the playground at recess. Let you sketch your way out of this one.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to a brand new series of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the first pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today.
You know how to get what you want, don't you? Would you not say that you agree, baby? You really think that you can school me in semantics? I can't recommend that, baby. I see through your antics. You think you're mysterious. You cannot be serious. You got lots of time to think up new ways to deceive yourself. You are Calipigian, but look at the state you're in. You got really nice clothes. Bet you didn't pay for those. What you got is a black belt in BS, but you can't hawk your pretty wares up in here anymore. Hit your head on the playground at recess. Let you sketch your way out of this one.
My guest on today's show, well, it's someone I've wanted to appear on the series for a very long time. As far back as his first solo album, in fact. As soon as I, and lots of people, heard 2010's Queen of Denmark, we kind of fell in love with his voice, with his songwriting, with his honesty, with his humour, and with his heart. The kind of golden AOR sound of that record soon evolved as my guest pursued his lifelong passion for synth pop and the darker edges of electronica. But that voice and that heart remain. I'm very pleased to be welcoming to The First Time, John Grant. In this show, John and I talk about his earliest musical passions and a youth that was dominated by a battle between his extremely conservative Christian upbringing and this obsessive love of music, and how his passion for the Eurythmics and Nina Hagen and Devo helped him find his identity. We also cover his time with his first proper band, Denver alt-rock group The Czars, and the battles with addiction that dominated his life until working with Midlake on The Queen of Denmark set him on the path that's now seen him release four more amazing records, the latest of which he's working on as we speak. There's a lot else in his show besides, so I'm going to stop describing it and get on with it. So let's start with the first question, which is, as I ask all my guests, when was the first time John was aware of music?
You know, the earliest memories I have of hearing stuff is... it's very, very strange because it was this weird mixture of... I had two teenage brothers when I was becoming aware of music, or who were about to become teenagers. They were 7 and 9 years older. And then my parents were into, like, hymns and Johnny Cash and Loretta Lynn and Roger Miller.
Roger Miller.
Who to this day is an ultra favorite of mine. Little Green Apples.
You can't roller skate in a buffalo herd.
And it's true and it's funny. Well, it's not true, actually. The kids are doing it all the time these days.
It was a musical household of kind of seeming contradictions, because I know you've talked about ABBA was around a lot.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I chose when I, you know, I heard them on the radio or something and went berserk.
What was it, a bit of a, because it's aggressively melodic and a very, for a kid, man.
I mean, SOS wrecked me as a little boy. You know, I'd never heard anything that beautiful in my whole life. And it's still one of the greatest things ever made.
Thank you. why is it so powerful, ABBA, to this day? Why do people love it so much?
Well, I mean, those melodies. You know, these days people sort of get off on the lyrics because they're pretty zany. Mm. You know, but back then, I mean, those melodies and those harmonies, you know, that perfect combination of Frida and Agneta is heavenly. They made incredible pop tunes, and they were a little bit weird, too. They weren't huge in the United States at the beginning. You know, it wasn't really cool to like ABBA, but I didn't care, of course, because I knew better.
Was your first single September, Earth, Wind & Fire, or was it Missing Persons was the other?
It was September, Earth, Wind & Fire.
Amazing first single.
How do you know that?
I've done my research, John.
Jeez Louise.
Tell me about getting that single. Tell me about the sleeve. Tell me about how you felt about that thing, that object.
Well, I got to take it into fifth grade for show and tell.
That's how much you loved it?
That's how much I loved it. And it was, you know, that was going to be my entry into the world of cool by presenting that to my classmates, you know.
Right.
But no one cared.
Oh.
Of course not. Yeah. It's a viper pit, fifth grade, you know.
Because the only image we have of that is what we've seen in John Hughes movies because we come from England. So, but is high school really, really that bad?
Oh, yeah. Much worse than that, I would say, than portrayed in the movies.
Do you remember?
Fifth grade was the end of grade school, and then came middle school, which was 6, 7, 8, and then high school was 9 through 12, and you don't learn anything in any of those. So,
but that song, like ABBA, it resonated with you, for want of a better
word. Oh man, it's still one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. That song is a supernova of a hit, and so beautiful, you know? So yeah, I mean, I had a 45 of it, and I don't think it had any artwork on it. It was one of those like paper sleeves with the hole cut out so that you could see the label of the record inside. I can't remember if it came with the plastic thingy in the middle, the plastic 45.
Little doofa.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if you had to buy those separately. I think my brothers had a bunch of them or something.
Where did you buy it from?
It must have been Kmart.
Okay.
Yeah. They had a big music section there. And I remember, staring for hours at Elton John's Captain Fantastic record. There were things that I wasn't supposed to see on that record. Nudity. Do you remember? the naked woman with the head of an owl?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was just standing there for hours going, wow, what in the name of high school football is going on here?
That's going to make the whole world of music quite potent for you if you've got things like that. What was the first album? Was it Upstairs at Eric's?
The first album I bought?
Hmm.
I think it would have been Eurythmics.
Oh.
Probably Touch.
Okay.
I mean, it changes all the time in my head, I'm sorry. But I think that's more interesting anyway, you know, because it's hard for me to remember exactly which was the first one. I mean, I wasn't allowed to have what was called secular music.
Yeah.
That was a big part of the story. So bringing, what's the word for when you bring stuff across the border?
smuggling things?
Yeah, smuggling. That's a word for the...
illicit music.
Contraband.
Oh, right.
Smuggling contraband into the house, you know, was completely out of the question. And the one that I remember the most having first is, you know, having the actual thing was Touch by Eurythmics. Huge, huge effect on me that album had.
It's contraband, but you're doing it anyway. Because you could have gone as a kid, well, actually, I'm not supposed to do this. I'm not supposed to play on the train tracks. I'm not supposed to bring records back. I'm not supposed to touch dad's whiskey bottles.
Right.
But you did it. You did bring music back.
Yeah, because I couldn't resist those sounds, those synthesizers.
That was a deep connection straight away. You could not have that music in your life to the point of, like, upsetting your parents, upsetting the church. You did it anyway.
Right, yeah. My sister and I would drive to church together once she was able to drive, and we could listen to the radio, whatever we wanted to listen to, instead of, like, hymns in the car with mom and dad, you know? And it was top 40 radio. That was Madonna's heyday when Like a Virgin and Lucky Star. I remember Lucky Star, that first record, was on heavy rotation on the radio. I don't know. It was a really amazing time. But there was such a mishmash on popular radio, much more of a mishmash on top 40 radio than there is now.
Yeah.
So many different styles. So, you know, when I heard Sweet Dreams, that album was great. But then Touch came out. And, of course, that's when things really, really exploded for them. I mean, Sweet Dreams was, of course, a super smash hit. But then their follow-up was even better, in my humble opinion. And that had a couple of songs on it. One was called No Fear, No Hate, No Pain, No Broken Hearts, which is, to this day, one of my favorites. And also Paint a Rumor and Aqua. And Here Comes the Rain Again is one of the greatest pop hits ever made. But I especially loved, you know, all these weird backing vocals that they were doing. They were doing such interesting things at the time. So, you know, it wasn't really, I didn't really have a choice. You know, I was going to have it one way or the other. You know, I was going to go listen to it at a friend's house, or I was going to borrow a cassette and see how that went. You know, that's probably what I did when I had to go to work. You know, when I started going to the coal mines at the age of 3, you know, I started buying my own cassettes, you know.
Aside from seeing music in church, or maybe seeing like a religious band, church band, was there like an important first concert you went to, a gig of the music that you had that was pulling you that way?
I didn't get to see anything. Like the first thing I saw was maybe Eurythmics when they were into their fifth album.
So you didn't do a lot of gigs when you were a teen?
No, it wasn't something that you were allowed to do, you know. My parents weren't going to have that. They weren't going to pay for it. And we lived out in the middle of nowhere. And I don't know, I heard maybe kids at school talking about doing these things.
Oh, man, that's tough.
And I just wanted to see Eurythmics more than anything. And Devo, of course, back in the day. And all I got to go to was see a band called Second Chapter of Acts, which was, you know, I've talked about them.
Yeah.
And they're great. They were incredible musicians and they were incredible harmonizers and, you know, two sisters and a brother. And they had synths on stage and did, you know, big synth solos and stuff. So I could get my fix of certain things there. But I never got to see any of the bands that I loved back then.
But I guess that longing and wanting to see the concerts, being unable to, that's dynamite. That's like I am setting out my path.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why I ended up having to do music, perhaps part of it, because maybe I was thwarted a bit back in the beginning. It's weird to think back on. I can't believe all the stuff I missed. I never saw Grace Jones back then. I only recently saw her for the first time. I never saw Devo. I never saw any of the stuff that I loved.
Tell me about the first, I was going to say, is it the first horror movie that made an impact or the first soundtrack that made an impact? I guess they made the same thing.
Yeah.
So this is, we're talking 80s again, aren't we here?
It wouldn't have been the first horror movie that made an impact because I'd seen a few. I'd been able to see a few at other people's houses, you know, for example. But you were about to mention John Carpenter, I believe.
I am about to mention John Carpenter.
Yeah. So because, you know, when I bought the cassette of Halloween 3.
The cassette.
Yeah, I was in California on a marching band trip. We were playing in the Rose Bowl parade.
I didn't know you were in a marching band.
Yeah, I played the saxophone. I played the alto saxophone.
Were you good?
I was, yeah. And it was a trip out to California. I'd been there once when I was like 4 or 5 years old because we had relatives out in L.A. Hmm. I went out walking by myself and found a music store.
Right.
And I was pretty mesmerized by the palm trees out there.
Yeah.
Which I am to this day. I love those tall, skinny palm trees. I can't get enough. Anyway, found a record store and went in there and saw that they had the cassette of, you know, the score to this film. And that was a foreign concept to me, buying the score to a movie.
Right.
And I thought, huh, that's weird. But I'm going to buy it because I love that movie. And so I put this cassette in my Walkman and Bob was my uncle.
Did you walk around like L.A. in the evening listening to that soundtrack?
I did.
That's gonna...
Dusk. Dusk in L.A. listening to, you know, this super, super impressionable kid who knows nothing about the world. And I'm walking around L.A. by myself, probably 14, 15, something like that. And just in heaven. Just can't believe the beauty that's coming out of those headphones. Just the most beautiful, beautiful music. It's still as important to me now as it was the first time I heard it.
Listening to that with a little foam things on the headphones.
Yeah, that's how it was. And I can think back to opening the cassette, like taking the plastic off that cassette in some parking lot, some big, gigantic LA parking lot at dusk, you know, surrounded by palm trees and the sun's going down. And I just remember the pink orange of the sky at that point, you know, and just being in heaven as that music starts coming through those little foam headphones. If there was a movie made about my life, that would have to be an important scene in the movie.
Music. Riley and Co. on BBC Radio 6 Music. Mark and Gideon join forces.
Every Monday to Thursday.
Two presenters.
It's the 6 Music Super Team, to be fair.
Four nights.
Friday's off then. Okay.
A couple of live bands.
And loads of brilliant music too. We're two mates trading records. And chatting late into the night. With live bands, archive sessions, plus the inevitable arguments. Full blown, I expect.
And we'll be playing all sorts of records, new and old, business as usual.
Riley and Co. Listen Monday to Thursday night from 9, or anytime on BBC Sounds. It's Matt Everett's The First Time with John Grant.
6 Music.
You could probably say I'm difficult. I probably talk too much. I overanalyze and overthink things. Yes, it's a nasty crush. I'm usually only waiting for you to stop talking so that I can. Concerning two-way streets, I have to say that I am not a fan. But I am the greatest living creature you are ever gonna meet. From the top of my head down to the tips of the toes on my feet. So go ahead and love me. You could be laughing 65% more of the time. Half of the time I think I'm in some movie. I play the underdog, of course. I wonder who they'll get to play me. Maybe they could dig up Richard Burton's course. I am not who you think I am. I am quite angry, which I barely can conceive. You think I hate myself, but it's you I hate, because you have the nerve to make me feel. I am the greatest living creature you are ever gonna meet. From the top of my head down to the tips of the toes on my feet. So go ahead and love me while it's still a crime. Don't forget you could be laughing 65% more of the time. You could be laughing 65% more of the time. 'Cause I am the greatest living creature.
When did you realize you had that voice?
I think you mentioned that.
I haven't realized that I can sing.
Oh, John, come on. No. Like, you've said that you first sang in public in Germany. That was like your first sort of public performance.
Yeah. But super drunk and at a party and sort of just improv, and it was weird. But there were a couple of people there that were like, hey, wow. You've got, you know, embracing that was doing the wrong thing.
What do you mean?
Well, because it was, I don't know, Irish have sayings about it, you know, like putting on airs, you know, like it was like rising above your station, thinking that you could do this thing that you were watching other people do.
Okay.
First of all, it was wrong and sinful to even be in that world. It can't be overstated how big of a deal that was to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I didn't want to lose my family and all the people that, you know, that I... this community that I was a part of, and you were betraying all of them by indulging in this other world, you know, becoming part of the world. You can't imagine how deep the indoctrination goes.
These are the two things
the thing that you've loved because you're born into your family and your community and your friends. And the other thing, your thing, you're being pulled towards, as you've said, pulled towards. I have found something that's me.
Right.
And those two things cannot coexist.
Right. And those two things cannot coexist. And I was also, you know, the sexuality thing is inextricable from this story too, because I was realizing that was slowly coming more and more into focus, that that was something that wasn't just a passing phase with me. And I was doing everything that I could to make sure that that didn't surface, but everybody around me could see it and told me about it constantly, 24/7. So it was a nightmare. It was like the metamorphosis with Franz Kafka, like waking up in the morning as a giant insect and coming to, you know, realize this horror. You know, it's like a body horror movie is how I would translate it into film.
It's a Cronenberg thing.
It is. It is definitely a Cronenberg thing for me. And that's why I suppose I've always been fascinated by those things.
Yeah.
In particular, that story from Kafka and also, you know, things like Tetsuo's The Iron Man.
Yeah, that's a freaky movie.
Metal Man or Iron Man?
Iron Man.
Yeah. And, you know, I love body horror and this the metamorphosis into some sort of horrible, horrible creature. And that's the kind of movie I'd make if I could make a movie. And who knows, maybe I can.
Okay.
But back then, it was terrifying and obscene for me to imagine that I could write my own music and assert myself in any way.
So how do you go from that to kind of pulling apart the sinew to go, well, I have to start performing, I have to start singing, I have to start writing. This is...
Well, I had to drink a lot.
Okay.
I had to be effed up.
That was the fuel that let you pull those two worlds apart and then start performing and start singing.
Yeah. I mean, it was betrayal of the foulest kind, putting the thoughts that I was having to paper. And it took me decades to even really sing about what I really wanted to sing
about.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
When I look back on it, when I see what I was and what I continue to be as a result of that, I just can't believe it. I see somebody like my friend, Cozy Fanny Tootie, who together with her partner has made some of the most important art and music in the world to me. You know, obviously her story is not mine to tell and she's done it herself anyway, but when she saw that she couldn't coexist with what she was surrounded by, she just left and went and did her own thing. I can't even imagine that. I had to be high to be able to start extricating myself from this indoctrination.
Yeah.
It's like being pulled out of a cult. You know, what people go through for years and years and years, and you never, never really ever get rid of it completely. You know, you figure out a way to exist in spite of that.
Yeah. I wasn't really going to talk about the SARS, but I know you don't like that era very much, but I guess that's because I was listening to, like, Paint the Moon this morning, and I was like, it's a beautiful piece of music.
Well,
but
that's,
I guess
that's one of the best things I ever wrote, for sure.
That era, what you're just talking about, is encapsulated in that, oh, there's a band that's starting to happen, there's movement, some building popularity, but it's so locked in with the process that you're talking about.
Yeah, that's why it's difficult for me to think about that.
Yeah.
The fact that I couldn't have good relationships with the people in the band was because I couldn't get a handle on myself. I couldn't figure out what I was, and there was so much disgust and shame and horror as to what I was that it wasn't okay, and I wanted to be something different, and I couldn't be anything other than what I was, and that wasn't going to be good enough for me. Either you commit suicide or you figure out a way to live. You know, the reason I probably didn't commit suicide was because I was told that I would go to hell if I did. I hear people smirking and laughing about other people's stories when they talk about these things, and they're just like, gosh, what a small intellect you must have had. You know, what a simpleton you must have been. How can people get hoodwinked by things? And, you know, there is that too.
I think it's incredibly brave. I think this is the thing that you haven't mentioned. I think it's so... To find the strength to do that, no matter if the tools that enabled you to do that weren't necessarily great for you at that time, I think it's hugely brave. I think it's kind of wonderful.
Well, yeah, looking at it from that perspective, it is, and I can see that as well. But I tell you, I went and saw Devo. You know, we talk about how I never got to see any of these bands. Mm. And I went and saw them recently at the Apollo. And I had tears streaming down my face for most of that concert. You know, that music was survival to me. And they were right about everything that they were talking about, which is why I connected to it back then. And, you know, I remember trying to play a song for my mother in the car. Like, you've got to see the genius of this. It's so incredible. And it was Speed Racer, this song on, was probably not the right entry point for her, in that particular song. Because, you know, they're talking, they're like, I'm a Barbie doll and I like sex. My mom was just absolutely horrified. Can you imagine? I mean, you've got Megan Thee Stallion and Nicki Minaj singing WAP these days, front and center on the radio.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And my mom couldn't stand, you know, somebody doing a parody about gender roles saying, you know,
yeah,
I'm a doctor and here's your bill. And I'm a Barbie doll and I like sex. And talking about, you know, stereotypes and stuff like that. It just wasn't going to happen. And so when I sat there and watched Devo the other night, it's very, very difficult for me to cry for some reason. The tears come very, very slowly and very with much difficulty, you know. But when I sat there watching Devo, I was able to sort of let go a little bit because I thought about the last 40 years, 45 years, what that music has meant to me and how it was survival.
What's the Devo track we should play at this point?
There are so many incredible masterpiece tracks, you know, Jerking Back and Forth, Going Under, Girl You Want, Gates of Steel, Snowball, Sloppy, in parentheses, I Saw My Baby Gettin', which is one of my favorite song titles of all time. Incredible stuff. There's a song that fills me with such joy when I hear it that it's hard to describe, and it's called Explosions, and it's on Oh No, It's Devo.
One of the nice things about the Stars era is meeting Simon and the Cocteau's kind of connection. So we have to really talk about the Cocteau twins. We have to talk about that.
Yeah.
That music, that legacy. How did they first come into your life and why are they so important to you?
Oh, man. I mean, I was able to give them a visionary award at the Ivor Novello's recently.
Wow.
Stand up on stage and give it to Robin and Liz. Simon wasn't able to make it. And it was huge because I stood there and, you know, there were two other idols in the room that night, Peter Gabriel and Robert Smith. I mean, giants for me.
Mm-hmm.
I spent my whole life listening to those guys. And here I was, you know, asked to come on stage and give the visionary award to Cocteau Twins. And I stood there and I talked about how, you know, living out in the middle of nowhere, out in the dusty fields of Parker, Colorado, where there was nothing. You could see the Rockies in the distance on the horizon. It was beautiful. In our front yard, we could see the whole range of the Rockies off in the distance. And then these fields of weeds and just stretching on for miles and miles and miles as far as the eye could see. And, you know, you couldn't fly a kite out there in the country because you'd, you know, end up on Saturn. But I did have a kite that I used to try and fly in the fields out there, you know, and I called it Woodstock because I loved Woodstock from Peanuts, the little yellow bird, you know. It was a pretty strange setting to discover this otherworldly music. And I talked at that awards ceremony about what it was like for me to listen to that music and that it saved my life. No, it really did. It really did.
That's beautiful.
I don't think I would have survived without the music that I had, without Devo and without Cocteau Twins and Missing Persons and New Order and Nina Hagen.
she looms large for me too.
Mm.
Because of when you hear me talk about what I grew up in, being confronted with something like Nina Hagen's Nonsex Monk Rock album, it just blew my mind wide open.
Yeah.
And terrified me, actually. But Cocteau Twins, coming back to the point, I think that my entry was treasure, like it was for so many in the States. Just thinking, wow, how can this be? How can this exist? There was a point when my parents stopped. They realized that they couldn't
halt the tide.
They couldn't, you know. But Cocteau Twins, everything they did was a huge thing. And I remember all these summers in Colorado. I remember driving around on the highways in the summers, listening to Echoes in a Shallow Bay and Tiny Dynamine, those EPs. They were so prolific, especially around 86. Victoria Land came out, which is one of the most beautiful records ever made in all possible galaxies.
As yet undiscovered by man or woman, yeah.
It's a fact. And of course, you know, went back to Head Over Heels and Garlands, and I never looked back. It was Cocteau Twins for all eternity after that, and has never stopped. Nothing's ever come close. Nothing ever will.
It's the return of Lamac.
Are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin.
Steve Lamac's Tea Time Session on 6 Music.
Yes, I'm back with a new 3-hour weekly show, showcasing our latest discoveries and some of my favourite music from the past. Join us every week for the best sessions from artists old and new. There'll be exclusive first plays, big interviews, and artists explaining how they wrote the songs you love.
Steve Lamac's Tea Time Session.
Every Monday afternoon from 4 on 6 Music.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
And you can listen to previous shows anytime on BBC Sounds.
6
Unstoppable, your confidence unspeakable. I know, you know, but I know that you know. I'm willing to do anything to get attention from you, dear, even though I don't. This is like a well-oiled machine. Could I please see that smile again? It's all that makes me feel that I'm living in this world. I see you closing all the doors. I see the walls as they go up. I know it's what you have to do. Probably do the same thing to my dear. Say them slowly.
So Queen of Denmark is 2010, which is kind of crazy thinking that it's that far back. And obviously it was a record that changed everything. Looking back now, how do you feel about that, the collection of songs?
I feel good about it.
Yeah?
Yeah, I do. I don't feel disgusted by it.
You certainly shouldn't. Very good songs.
You know, I got to tell you this. I got to say this on the radio, but, you know, another one of my, you know, Lush, huge band.
Yeah.
For me. Recently, Emma Anderson made a list of her favorite albums, and she put Queen of Denmark on there. She doesn't have any idea what a huge deal that is for me. She does now. Are you out there, Emma? I mean, she's an incredible musician, and she's got a new album out, which I'm really chuffed about, and It's as beautiful as you would imagine that it would be. And I'm so happy for her, because she's a big one for me.
But seeing that record build so warmly and so gently and so authentically... Mm. People just found their record,
yeah.
And they mentioned it to friends.
Yeah.
It maybe appeared in a little list, and it just it, and going to the shows at that time, they would just build and they build and they build, and it felt like we all kind of owned it. We all had that. I found this. My friends have found this. It was beautiful to be on that side of it. I guess it must have been pretty nice to have been on the stage and microphone side of it.
Well, I mean, it was a really sound a little bit like a broken record here, but. It was a very difficult time. I mean, I was really bottoming out during that time. Things were really coming to a head for me in my life. It took ages and decades, and I'm still working on it, to face the amount of denial that I was in about what I had been through and what I couldn't accept about myself and all this stuff. And all the way through the Czars, I was just sinking. You know, I was a man who was grasping at straws and just doing anything to survive, truly, because I was sinking, and I didn't know whether I was coming or going. And you can hear it in the music, because I didn't, you know, I didn't know. I had nothing to hold on to, really, you know. So it was a very, might sound quite dramatic, but that's exactly what it felt like, and that's what it was psychologically. So the fact that Queen of Denmark was the first time that I was able to say exactly what I wanted to say, that I had full control over everything. And I was able to really start showing myself what I could do if I made a concerted effort, you know, in a specific direction of some sort. I wasn't necessarily wanting to make a 70s AOR type of record, you know, which is what Queen of Denmark ended up being, and which I'm happy it is that, because I love it for exactly the way it is. But, you know, I wanted to make an electronic record.
Yeah.
Because that's my true love, you know, synthesizers. But I didn't know how to do it on my own. I was just starting to learn how to program and do things, and I had no idea what I was doing. So I did it with Midlake. They just were with me the whole way. Another thing that can't be overstated, how important that experience was for me. So yeah, I'm proud of that record. And even though, you know, whenever I listen to it, I'm just like, oh, wow, shouldn't have done that. Shouldn't have sang that like that. You should have learned the songs before you recorded that record. That's something I've never done. I don't learn the songs and then go into the studio. They only really come into their own when I start singing them live, because that's when you finally actually learn them. Because you've just written it when you're in the studio.
But that's the moment to capture it, though, when you've just written it.
Perhaps. Surely. I don't know. I get better at singing them, I feel like. Everything about me is so controlled. You know, I'm so controlled. I want full control. You know, there's this hypervigilance and control. Mm-hmm. Which is a defense mechanism and a reaction to my experience growing up.
Which is why you like sequences, which is why you like every button, every knob you can turn, you can control exactly. Yeah. We love guitarists and we love bass players and we love those things, but this is, you have total control over it.
Yeah.
With the option as well of pressing some buttons when it all goes crazy if you feel like going there.
Yeah.
That's why you like synthesizers.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, it's a great way to think about it. If I want to lose it, I can't lose it with my voice the way I want to, because I have this really velvety, croony type of voice, and it's very difficult for me. I don't have a good scream. No, I really,
really
don't. No, I don't. Otherwise, I'd be doing it nonstop, 24/7, so lucky you that I don't. I love punk music for that reason, for the screaming that people are able to do. It's physically impossible for me to do that. But, you know, when I see Pixies and I hear Frank Black scream like that, it's heaven to me. It really, really resonates with me. So I have to figure out different ways to express it. And I try and do it with my words.
Back then I often found myself driving on the road at night, and the radio was broadcasting the ocean. Warm late spring wind whips through my hair. I am right here, but I want to be there. And no one in this world is gonna stop me.
driving 36 to Boulder. I was getting warm, but now I'm getting colder. And I stomp my feet, I'm bending like a child. I hope you get everything you wanted, boy. I hope you conquer the world and turn into a toy. But don't come crying when you're forced to learn the truth. Pale green ghosts at the end of May, soldiers of this black highway, helping me to know my place.
So Pale Green Ghosts is the first complete vision, isn't it?
It really is.
Not only is it a great record, it's a success. It's top 40. Mm. It's everything that you could possibly want that record to be.
It's funny because, you know, Mojo wasn't very happy with it. They gave it 3 stars. They just sort of brushed it by the wayside. They weren't in the mood for that. It seemed like, you know, they wanted the follow-up to Queen of Denmark. That's fine, because it's none of my business, any of that. That's has nothing to do with what I'm doing. You got to do what you got to do. And I felt very emboldened at that point, because, you know, I was super into Goldfrapp. Those first couple of Goldfrapp records were monumental for me as well. And when I heard Goldfrapp's second record, you know, there were a lot of people that were disappointed with it, because they were like, what are they doing this electronic stuff for? Because, you know, Felt Mountain was such a noir movie of a record.
Good description.
Right? But they kept all of that and put this new clothing on it. That's still my favorite record, Black Cherry. That record was really huge for me back then. And that made me feel like, well, if they can do that, make that transition like that, they still were exactly who they were.
Yeah.
That's the thing. But people were like, oh, what are they trying to do this? Or who do they think, you know, it's like, no. They're still exactly who they were when they did that other thing. So that made me think, well, then you can do that.
Yeah. So we're obviously talking about lots of influences, and I'd always like to think if I was in a position to be a successful musical artist and you get the luxury of getting people that you admire on your records, isn't that surely half the point of the entire exercise of being a musician? So obviously getting Budgie is like, if you're a Susie fan...
Yeah, and boy was I.
And you're in a position in your career where you can start, hey, I could give them a call and they might get on board. The Susie thing runs deep, clearly.
Oh, of course. Swimming Horses.
That's the one.
That's the one for me. I can't get enough of that track to this very day.
Budgie is also, you know, what an incredible human being that guy is. I didn't feel like I deserved him, but I didn't care. I just was glad that he was there.
Because those live shows, he's such a presence.
He is.
Musically, yeah. But also there's, he sort of exudes this.
He's a rock and roll drummer. He's a rock star. Yeah. You know, he's, but he also made all of this incredible music, you know. So that was a big deal. And I've gotten to meet a lot of the people that I admire so much and who have meant the world to me in music. And they really don't disappoint, because I think you're in a good place. If you only expect to meet a flawed human being, then you're not going to be disappointed, because that's all there is on offer on this planet, you know.
So Boy from Michigan, I remember it coming out, and you talked a lot about, oh, it's the first record that you've done since you turned 50.
Right.
That surfaced once or twice in interviews, and I thought, that's kind of interesting. As a person that's not that long.
Yeah.
Every birthday is a point for self-reflection, and every point in our life we look back and think about who we were and who we are and who we're going to be in that journey. But like, doing that record, turning 50, looking at what you've done this far, you know, and the little side runs here and there, you know, the Creepshow and all these other interesting collaborations. And I mean, to have a career that's got Creepshow on one side and Elton John on the other, that's fun.
That is good.
So reaching that point in your life and doing that record, which talks about you as well.
Yeah.
How do you feel about where you are now?
I feel good for the most part. I feel really good. I still feel like a baby when it comes to music and creating.
What do you mean?
Well, I still feel like I'm just getting started when it comes to music. Like, everything I've done has been me sorting through billions of files, trying to figure out what exactly my voice is. Sorting through billions of swatches of fabric, trying to figure out what specific type of quilt I'd like to make when it comes to music. So I feel like I'm just slowly getting closer and closer. And I feel like an infant. It's the truth. It's nice to be able to have a lot of tools and access to things to be able to do what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great feeling. And, you know, I have lots of great relationships with people that I absolutely adore in my life and respect and admire. And so that's huge for me. And what else can I say?
That'll do.
Yeah. That's pretty important.
What's the final track we should play, John?
Oh, boy. Maybe we should play something from Cocteau Twins. Oh, man. Pink Owen Dread by Cocteau Twins is the quintessential driving on the highway in the middle of the summer, smelling the pale green ghosts in the air, which were the Russian olive trees. Driving on the highway, windows down, Walkman in, because the stereo in my car doesn't work. So I'm listening to Tiny Dynamite and Echoes in a Shallow Bay nonstop. And so, yeah, Pink Orange Red, let's listen to that, shall we?
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matt. Always a pleasure. Fabricia, 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 Fabricia,
Orange Red by Cocteau Twins. The final choice of my guest on The First Time this week, John Grant. I'll be back tomorrow with a brand new episode of The First Time, where my guest will be Stormzy. And of course, you can listen back to previous First Time shows from the archive, which include my conversations with Tom York, Elton John, Kevin Rowlands, and two episodes from this season with Holly Johnson and Kate LeBon. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.